My name is Susan Rand, and today we're going to do a little reading of William Wordsworth's lines composed a few miles above Tintern Abbey on revisiting the banks of the Wye during a tour July 13th, 1798, was the title I was trying to think of at lunchtime. But before we do, I'd just like to sort of gather our thoughts for a minute by reading a few lines from this poem. As sort of a meditation. At this point in the poem, Wordsworth is talking about his experience in the presence of natural beauty and what it does to him. And he says, speaking of the scenes now, "To them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime. That blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony, and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things." That's a little bit of what this poem's about, and I'd like to get the feeling of the group whether we would like to just read it together to start with. Then I'll say a few things, and then we'll start to pull it apart. Do people feel extroverted enough to take a few lines of poetry and read them out loud? It's good old-fashioned English iambic pentameter, but it's actually not all that hard to read. And it breaks down into about, actually, four distinct thoughts with a little 10-line moment of doubt in the middle. So if we wanted to read it that way, in other words, someone read to about line 23, where the hermit sits alone. Someone else read from the beauteous forms to the end of the moment of doubt, which is, "How often has my spirit turned to thee?" Someone else read from "and now" with half-extinguished thought to the part about all of my moral being, and then someone else read the end, where he suddenly realizes that he's there with his sister. So, anyone want to start?
I'll start.
Okay.
All right, all the way back to the sophomore Brit Lit.
That's right. That's why I picked this one.
No, I never had anybody.
Okay.
Well, I especially want Barbara to listen.
Okay.
5 years have passed, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters. And again I hear these waters rolling from their mountain springs with a soft inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs that on a wild, secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion and connect the landscape with the quiet of the sky. The day is come when I again repose here under this dark sycamore and view these plots of cottage ground, these orchard tufts, which at this season, with their unripe fruits, are clad in one green hue and lose themselves mid groves and copses. Once again I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees, with some uncertain notice, as might seem of vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods, or of some hermit's cave, where by his fire the hermit sits alone.
These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye, but oft in lonely rooms and amid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them, in hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood and felt along the heart, and passing even into my purer mind with tranquil restoration. Feelings too of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as have no slight or trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life, his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less I trust to them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. If this be but a vain belief, yet, oh, how oft, in darkness and amid the many shapes of joyless daylight, when the fretful stir unprofitable and the fever of the world have flung upon the beatings of my heart, how oft in spirit have I turned to thee, O Sylvan Wye, thou wanderer through the woods, how often has my spirit turned to thee.
And now, with gleams of half-extinguished thought, with many recognitions dim and faint, and somewhat of a sad perplexity, the picture of the mind revives again. While here I stand, not only with the sense of present pleasure, but with pleasing thoughts that in this moment there is life and food for future years. And so I dare to hope, though changed, no doubt, from what I was when first I came among these hills, when like a roe I bounded o'er the mountains, by the sides of the deep rivers and the lonely streams, wherever nature led, more like a man flying from something that he dreads than one who sought the thing he loved. For nature, then, the coarser pleasures of my boyish days and their glad animal movements all gone by, to me was all in all. I cannot paint what then I was. The sounding cataract haunted me like a passion, the tall rock, the mountain, and the deep and gloomy wood. Their colors and their forms were then to me an appetite, a feeling and a love that had no need of a remoter charm, by thought supplied, nor any interest unborrowed from the eye. That time is past, and all its aching joys are now no more, and all its dizzy raptures. Not for this faint I, nor mourn, nor murmur. Other gifts have followed. For such loss I would believe abundant recompense. For I have learned to look on nature not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still sad music of humanity, nor harsh nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean, and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man. A motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. Therefore am I still a lover of the meadows and the woods and mountains, and of all that we behold from this green earth, of all the mighty world of eye and ear, both what they half create and what perceive. Well pleased to recognize in nature and the language of the sense the anchor of my purest thoughts, the nurse, the guide, the guardian of my heart and soul of all my moral being.
Anyone want to take the end? Sure.
Nor perchance, if I were not thus taught, should I the more suffer my genial spirits to decay. But thou art with me here upon the banks of this fair river, thou my dearest friend, my dear, dear friend. And in thy voice I catch the language of my former heart, and read my former pleasures in the shooting lights of thy wild eyes. Oh, yet a little while may I behold in thee what I was once, my dear, dear sister. And this prayer I make, knowing that nature never did betray the heart that loved her. 'Tis her privilege, through all the years of this our life, to lead from joy to joy. For she can so inform the mind that is within us, so impressed with quietness and beauty, and so feed with lofty thoughts, that neither evil tongues, rash judgments, nor the sneers of selfish men, nor greetings where no kindness is, nor all the dreary intercourse of daily life, shall e'er prevail against us, or disturb our cheerful faith, that all which we behold is full of blessings. Therefore, let the moon shine on thee in thy solitary walk, and let the misty mountain winds be free to blow against thee. And in after years, when these wild ecstasies shall be matured into a sober pleasure, when thy mind shall be a mansion for all lovely forms, thy memory be as a dwelling place for all sweet sounds and harmonies, oh, then, if solitude or fear or pain or grief should be thy portion, with what healing thoughts of tender joy wilt thou remember me? And these my exhortations. Nor, perchance, if I should be where I no more can hear thy voice, nor catch from thy wild eyes these gleams of past existence, wilt thou then forget that on the banks of this delightful stream we stood together, and that I, so long a worshipper of nature, hither came unwearied in that service. Rather say, with warmer love, oh, with far deeper zeal of holier love. Nor wilt thou then forget that after many wanderings, many years of absence, these steep woods and lofty cliffs, and this green pastoral landscape, were to me more dear, both for themselves and for thy sake.
All right. We should start a verse chorus here. Everybody is really good at reading poetry. You can probably guess already why I picked this to be the opening piece for this, as people return to Holden, or from my experience for the first time, I'm a little like Dorothy in this poem. There are a few things that I want to say about Wordsworth, just a few, before we start going into the poetry, sort of set a context. But I'll keep them brief and simple and somewhat light. Most people tend to think of William Wordsworth as the great poet of nature. This is the guy who wrote, "My heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky," and "I wandered lonely as a cloud, and then I saw a crowd of golden daffodils," and all that stuff. And for most part, that's a pretty fitting designation, but Wordsworth was a little more than this sort of unreflecting pantheist bouncing around through the Lake Country in England, finding God in daffodils. To say that about him, you sort of miss the pervasive fact that the favorite topic of his poetry was himself. Here's a guy who wrote an epic poem, I mean a 600-page poem, about the growth of his own mind. It was called The Prelude, and it was meant to be a prelude to the actual poem that he was going to write, but he got to the end of it and discovered that he'd actually written an epic about himself. And the titles are, the chapters, "My Years at Cambridge," "My Years in the Alps," "My Years in France," "My Imagination Impaired." The man was sort of interested in the process of his own mind, and that way he sort of became, he sort of was a foreshadow of modern thought in any way, and certainly modern poetry. And as much as I sound like I'm making a little fun of him, he really did believe that you have to be a good person before you become a good poet. And so the process of becoming a good person was what he was sort of concerned with. And in this kind of dynamic, nature functioned as kind of a spiritual exercise video for him. Insofar as he, as long as he had prolonged and repeated contact with nature, it sort of put him in poetic shape, and he was enabled to hone and habitualize his feelings, which then would sort of burst forth into poetry. Now I want to read just a, this is really a convoluted, when I read this, it'll be clear why Wordsworth wrote poetry and not prose. This is from the only piece of prose that he wrote where he was sort of, actually his friend Coleridge made him write it to explain why he wrote poetry. And it's in the preface to the poems they wrote together, the lyrical ballads. And I'll try to read it slowly so that the thoughts hang together, because it's pretty weird, but it's got it all in it. For all good poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. And though this be true, poems to which any value can be attached were never produced on any variety of subjects, but by a man who, being possessed of more than unusual organic sensibility, had thought long and deeply. For our continued influxes of feelings are modified and directed by our thoughts, which are indeed representatives of all our past feelings. So, by the repetition and continuance of this act, our feelings will be connected with important subjects, till at length, if we be originally possessed of much sensibility, such habits of mind will be produced that by obeying blindly and mechanically the impulse of those habits, we shall describe objects and utter sentiments of such a nature and in such connection with each other that the understanding of the reader must necessarily be in some degree enlightened and his affections strengthened and purified. Next to James Joyce, that's probably the world's longest sentence, I think. But to unpack it, first of all, there's not a word about nature in it. There's not a word about what's out there. It's all about Wordsworth, the poet, thoughts and feelings and their interaction with each other. Thought and feeling and thought and feeling, building up to a kind of habitual ability to have these great lofty moments that then spontaneously overflow. And poof, there's poetry. Not only poetry, but edifying and enlightening poetry. Now, to be able to spontaneously overflow with powerful feeling, you have to be a pretty special character, and Wordsworth thought he was a pretty special character, or thought he was trying to become a pretty special character. Again, this is from the preface. This is easier to hear. What is a poet? He is a man speaking to men. Well, this was 1798, folks. And most of them were then. A man, it is true, endowed with more lively sensibility, more enthusiasm and tenderness, who has a greater knowledge of human nature and a more comprehensive soul than are supposed to be common among mankind. A man pleased with his own passions and volitions, who rejoices more than other men in the spirit of the life that is in him, delighting to contemplate similar volitions and passions as manifested in the goings-on of the universe, and habitually impelled to create them where he does not find them. So the poet, this guy, the poet, not only habitually nurtures his thoughts and feelings, but he delights to see his thoughts and feelings reflected in the universe, right? Oh, there I am. There I am. Oh, that's just what I thought yesterday. But when the natural world, when he doesn't see them reflected, he infuses them. He habitually infuses the high, lofty tenderness and enthusiasm of his thoughts and feelings. So Wordsworth doesn't just see God in daffodils, he sees himself in daffodils and therefore feels God. And he calls this natural piety. This is a little trick. Is natural piety, and it's central to the poem we'll read tomorrow, Intimations of Immortality. But watch for it; it's a little Wordsworthian trick, and it plays a big part in his poetry. So where does nature come in? Well, that's when we get to Tintern Abbey. Nature fine-tunes the feelings, mostly during childhood, the part about childhood, without much active participation. Continued exposure to the vital spirit of nature creates potential little poets, and if they grow up to be more comprehensive souls and who think long and deeply about their feelings, they too can spontaneously overflow and become poets. Nature is the active agent in this equation, involved in half creation of the poet. You saw that line go by. And her or his genial spirits, which are the power of the imagination. But watch for those two favorite Wordsworthian phrases. They're like flags to indicate that the subject on the floor is the poet and some glory or trauma in his or her inspiration. So in Tintern Abbey, what we're basically doing is we're on a walk with Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy. I subtitled this little presentation in today, so I went for a walk with my sister. And he encounters this scene that half created his genial spirits about 5 years back, and he spontaneously overflows. Now, Wordsworth's relationship with his sister Dorothy was very special, and some biographers would say a little more special than that it should have been. They were separated for many years during their childhood, and then they were joyously reunited in their teens, and they never were parted again. Dorothy took care of Wordsworth, edited his manuscripts, hung out with Coleridge, sort of was that sort of supportive, sisterly, female other side to Wordsworth, and also accompanied him on all of these walks. He walked a lot. So in light of what we said earlier about power of nature, Wordsworth doesn't only see himself in nature in Tintern Abbey, but he sees himself in Dorothy. And I guess those kinds of things are sort of the only background stuff I'd like to say. So you get a sense of what we're talking about here in this poem, what he's in dialogue with when he encounters this scene of the why after having been there 5 years before. So at that note, that point, I guess I'd just like to, let's just plow right into it. Starting, I think we can break it up into the same parts we read it in, because I think the poem, and I think you felt it, moves through four different moments, and has sort of a resolution, and then a doubt, and then reaffirms the resolution, and then passes it on to the future. So we can start with the opening description to line, what, about 23. And I guess the first question I'd like to ask about is, anybody find anything funny in this description?
At first I thought he was in Holden Village.
Except there are any hedgerows in Holden Village.
And another thing, he mentioned the ocean, and I didn't see that.
Right, right. There's things here that aren't really there.
It reminded me when I was a child, we lived on one farm and it was full of rocks and all
kinds of
things.
That's me.
We had the sycamore tree on that road because he wasn't here.
He was in England. We'll drop that. Well, we know he's not in Holden. But it's the same kind of experience. It's the same kind of experience. Being in a place that has, you know, just your heart is in, or he would say made your heart be the heart that it is by being in this place. So in that way, it's holy.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
With this here, when it talks of the why,
mm-hmm.
is that a name of a river?
That's a river. Yeah, it's a river in. Here it is in the
Monmouthshire.
Ruins of a medieval abbey situated in the valley of the River Wye in Monmouthshire, noted for its scenery.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's a little hard to read.
What is a copse?
It's a little grove of trees. You know, a little pile of trees in the middle of a landscape. But do you notice that something's happening here in this description? There's a it's it starts out sounding like just a straight out description, but it's really not in many ways. I won't say any more than that unless you want me to. Well, let me throw this out. In terms of sense, the sense that he's relying on, this sounds like a description, but what is the word that he uses all the way through? I hear these waters. There's a behold. Then there's the quiet of the sky, sent up in silence. It's all oral images that he's putting out there. He starts out, it seems to be just a straightforward, yeah.
Visual scene, it's more of a heard scene.
Mm-hmm. And hearing, later on in the poem he talks about hearing the still sad music of humanity, is sort of it's more of an imaginative if you hear something in a scene, it's a little reference maybe to memory more than just what's visual. It's sort of taking over there, this memory. Almost by the sixth line, he's not seeing the scene anymore, he's remembering the scene, or remembering the effect of the scene on him. It's a neat little job he does here of trying to show us how the poetic imagination works without saying, and here's how the poetic imagination works, folks. The other great part about this is that as you get further through these lines, more and more of the scene disappears. I mean, he describes something and then he says it's not there anymore. He starts out, I behold these steep and lofty cliffs that on a wild secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion. It's immediately something he sees he starts to take away. And then just even the visual descriptions, the description of the cottage and the orchard tufts and the fruits, everything's clad in a green hue. It sort of becomes less distinct. He sees the hedgerows and then he says, oh, they're hardly hedgerows. I mean, they start to disappear. The pastoral part, the green goes right up to the door of the farms and then at the end there, this is the part I love, what you're left with at the end is somebody who's not really there.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's sort of this, it gets to this point where he's taking further and more and more stuff away from the scene as he describes it until he gets to the fact that maybe somewhere in this woods, somewhere, is a hermit's cave, and there next to the cave, the hermit sits alone. And I love that. I love that, what he does there, because what that's basically doing in what is a almost classic pastoral description, pastoral scene, is removing everything but the human element in some way, or using the scene to bring you to the human. And he does it sort of with a little trick, so that you're reading it. And it's moving along, and suddenly you go, what? What hermit? There's no hermit here. Who's this hermit guy? Where'd he come from? So I've always totally enjoyed it, those few sentences there, because they trick you.
Okay.
What? What is it?
Oh, it's the electric heater.
Oh. It sounds like a speaker buzzing. Funny.
Sometimes it helps to prop a chair up against it.
Ah.
You guys need to know these tricks, you teachers.
Just leave a chair.
Just leave a chair against it.
This is... Oh, that kind of lean a chair against it. Mm. Okay.
Have that vibration in the scene.
Right. We have a vibrating scene. Okay, moving right along to the next sort of big part of the poem. Anything anybody wants to say about it? Take as much time as you need to reread it since we've been away from it for a while.
It strikes me that what he does here is a lot like what Schleiermacher says theology is. He talks about tranquil restoration and about remembering your feelings. And then the thing that you most remember is this, when you become a living soul and you see into the life of things and you are harmonious with that light. Really, that's what Schleiermacher says theology is too, that to know God is to experience your absolute dependence on God and to see that unity. And theology is not talking about God, it's talking about that fundamental experience of God. And so theology, like poetry, is secondhand because it's thinking about an experience that's fundamental.
I like that.
And actually liberation theology, so I mean, the line group of many liberation theologians is that theology is the second act.
Mm-hmm.
It's a similar kind of thing, that it's experience of that of God that has to be prior to anything. Sort of intimacy comes before commitment is a line out of another book.
Well, one of the things that he... What? A commitment becomes before intimacy. Because one of the things that he really does talk about in throughout all of his poetry is the, in fact, he later goes on in the preface to talk about poetry is the spontaneous power, or spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, recollected in tranquility, which I saved that part for Phil looking at the immortality ode tomorrow, but that process of recollection and that process of transformation through recollection is real redemptive for Wordsworth. I mean, it's really clear what he's saying here is this saves me. This has saved me. This has made me, these feelings have no slight or trivial influence on the best portion of a good man's life. That this kind of redemptive power of nature through feeling.
And I guess a lot of people don't think that that makes for good theology. That theology should be about God, not about our experiences of God. But Schleiermacher says no, that theology is not knowledge. It's reflections on piety. It's hard to say if it makes for good theology or not. I guess we can debate that, but it certainly seems to make for good poetry.
Right. That's the Wordsworthian cornerstone. That's what makes good poetry.
I like the line 30 of the translation. It says, feelings too of unremembered pleasure. Sort of drawing out things that we didn't even remember before, and even in the midst of towns and cities, felt in the blood. Was a way in which it calls us back to something that we haven't even remembered.
That it's sort of like what you said before about when you said that he felt that you thought he was talking about being in Holden. Reading this made you feel what it felt like to be at Holden, and knew that he was feeling the same thing. And in some ways, when you're some day, maybe when you're walking down the street where you live, and suddenly you feel this feeling, from where did it come from? It came from Holden. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what I love about that line of unremembered pleasure. I mean, how can you not remember pleasure? It's that the half creation part, the part where nature comes and or God through nature, or however you want to talk about it, makes this happen.
Now, why does he have to describe it negatively in terms of the blind? It's not like the blind person with the landscape.
I think that's a reference. That's sort of an in joke to what he did in the first part. After he's totally taken away, sort of made it seem unconscious that he slipped into this recollective and poetic imagination kind of movement. Then he jumps in the next line and says, "These beauteous forms, as though through long absence, have not been to me as a landscape is to a blind man's eye." And I wrote in the margins next to it, "Oh yeah." You know, I think in some way that's more part of the lines that precede it, where he's sort of putting the period at the end of showing you how it works. Because it's, of course, it's not been to you as a landscape is to a blind man's eye. You know, you trying to fool us, we can figure you out, Wordsworth. But I don't know. I mean, that's sort of my feeling about it.
Well, unremembered pleasure would just probably mean that thing that they referred to pleasure they had never thought about anymore, but now they came back to it. That maybe what he meant?
Feelings of unremembered
feelings
pleasure.
That
yeah.
Came back to
the feeling is created. The feeling now itself creates in him, and he doesn't have to remember what gave him the feeling. The feeling's now there. And that's what makes him a good poet, or that's what poetry should be, is his position. I wanted to just point out the fact that he's still doing some of that stuff about, in fact, right in the middle of the first, what I call the first climax of the poem, which is this lay to sleep in body and become a living soul. That playing around with oral and visual images, he gets right there. He's got a quiet eye in line 48, with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and deep joy we see into the life of things. It's a different kind of seeing. And he's constantly pulling away from the eye as being the lens through which the world, the mind, the poet, the imagination contacts the world. He keeps sort of denigrating it, saying, you know, you just don't look at this stuff, you feel it. And so you get a quiet eye. And I love that image. It goes all the way through. In the next, 10 lines, 8 lines there, it's sort of like with the poem starts out with this deceptive description, and then he sort of lays out his philosophical belief about how this scene can impress him once. And then it's sort of like he goes, I'm not sure. I might be way off base here. This might be me going, you know, getting a little too goofy, and I need to like look at it again. And he pulls back and he looks at it again. So he has the moment of doubt. Oh, if this be but a vain belief. And then he starts again. Yet, oh, how oft in darkness and amidst blah, 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 my spirit has turned to thee. I don't know what this is. I mean, whatever you want to call it, I know that when I'm upset, distressed, someone's picking on me, the world is too much with me, I can think about Holden. My spirit returns to Holden, and I am empowered, and I am strengthened, and that's so, I don't know what you call it, just sort of what he's saying here. And then he starts to describe it again, and I think builds up to the real the real look at what this kind of stuff does. So why don't we move there from line 58.
It's one thing that is intriguing about this poem is very eerie to read from the point of view of what happened to Wordsworth in his life. I mean, how in fact nature did turn on him, or nature did betray him. Nature,
right,
in fact did betray Wordsworth. And so reading it from that perspective, this line seems like someone who suspects that this really is all going
to
fall apart. It's a long story, but
yeah,
the line comes as someone saying, "I've got to convince you of this."
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't strike me as if it's a real doubt. It strikes me as if it's a feigned doubt, so that he can come back.
So you can
and
come
say,
back and say it again, right? And a quick answer to the question, and if tomorrow we'll do Wordsworth again and the Immortality Ode, which is 5 years later, and already Wordsworth is saying, you know, I mean, this is the high point of Wordsworthian nature worship. You know, he's 28 years old here. He's just, you know, burst onto the poetic scene. He's writing the lyrical ballads with Coleridge. He's living in the Lake Country. He's totally blissed out. And then 5 years later, he's all these terrible things have started to happen to him. The French Revolution fails. All of his revolutionary stuff, and he starts to doubt whether nature can be redemptive, and he comes up with a new accommodation, and then finally later, actually, in his if he lived a long time, he lived to be 80 years old, and so by the time
he ended up selling out, he became part of the
poet
church,
laureate,
poet laureate,
and wrote poems about political figures and things like that. His great years were over by about 1805. And in between 1797 and 1805, he wrote some great stuff. But it is true. He's constantly arguing with himself. He's constantly arguing. I mean, the prelude is a huge argument with whether he's worthy to be a poet, and whether what he believes is really true. And what his experience is really true. One of the great critics of him wrote a book that's called The Confessional Imagination. He's constantly confessing, constantly. Wait, let me say it again. Let me say it one more time. Anyway, moving right along. We're at the gleams of half-extinguished thought. The reference to what you just said is the part from about line 62 to line 65, where he dares to hope that the present will be the life and food of his future years. He and then again he stops, and he goes back and looks at the past. He's trying to build it up to the confidence, some level of confidence in it.
Or did he write this poem in the, not all at one time, but in phases of his life or phases of time?
No, this poem he did write all at one time. Well, he wrote all in 1798. A lot of his stuff he did go back and edit. And change over the period of his life as his thoughts and feelings changed. And the earlier poems are always the better ones, in my mind. But this is supposed to give you the impression that he's almost sat down right there on the rock after he looked over the Valley of the Wye and pulled out a notebook and wrote it down. And in poetic time, that's what he did. He didn't take 3 years to write this poem.
Well, he makes it sound as though he's now ancient.
Right. He's 28 years old, right.
Well, but you can tell from line 66, 65 through 85 that he's already kind of running scared.
Mm-hmm.
Because he, in those lines, is probably, I think, the most, it's much less self-conscious. I mean, his whole life is consciousness reflecting on self. But here he's saying, when I was a kid, this is how I experienced mm-hmm. the woods. The woods to me were a place where I jumped and ran, and it was all in all. Every cataract was a passion. Just to see a mountain was great stuff. And we all know that. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a very powerful. We all have a way that we remember back to our first experience of, say, the mountains, if that happens to be our thing, or our first experience of reading or something. Mm-hmm. And then we move into an adult, you know, or our first love, the first mm-hmm. time that we were in love. And then we move into an adult thing. And here he really is alive to that first stuff yet once again. And he can encase it in a poem, but he won't be able to do this, you know, 5 years from now, because he'll realize that you can't encase an already encased poem yet another time, and still feel the initial ardor.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the person that saves this part for him is Dorothy later on, mm-hmm. Because he looks at her and he sees her bounding as a wild roe through the seeing the scene and being so completely and so he sort of asks her to carry it on for him in a way. I mean, it's he's already sort of sad in this mm-hmm. poem, but it's definitely one of his most upbeat. Also, I think somewhere in that description, wait a second. Oh, he does, at the very end of that description of childhood and the unmediated experience of nature, he wraps the eye again. A feeling and a love that had no, wait a minute, that had no need of a remoter charm, by thought supplied, nor any interest unborrowed from the eye. That, you know, he's...
In other words, it was all visual.
Yeah. He's already setting that up as, this was what made me who I am in the unremembered pleasures, but who I am now recollects in tranquility of this, and it's not as unmediated. It is mediated. Yeah.
And then there's a disclaimer again: not for this faint eye, line 85. This isn't mm-hmm. what I'm. This isn't making me discouraged. Other gifts have followed.
Mm-hmm. And the other gifts that have followed, I think, are some of the best lines of his poetry. mm-hmm. I mean, really. But hearing oftentimes the still sad music of humanity. Sort of putting, and again, it's hearing music, you know, he's not seeing. He doesn't see the poet in the landscape, he hears. He doesn't see the human in the landscape, he hears the human in the landscape. That feeling reflected in nature thing is all, the poetic term for it is synesthesia, where you use the wrong sense, or you counterpose your senses. And he uses it always. It's like a bell ringing to say, "This is not unmediated. This is mediated. This is through the poetic imagination and the development of my genial spirits that we're talking about here." And then he restates his belief from the first statement of it. The code word there is joy. It ends with joy. At the end of that first little, I don't know if you can call it a stanza, movement, the deep power of harmony and the deep power of joy we see into the life of things. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts. Those are like yoking the whole poem together, that sense of joy.
I like the idea of joy being disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that?
Line 95. Oh. No, 94. 94.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, similar.
The part that follows there. The counter. Posing, the counterposition, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and in the mind of man. That sets up the half creation thing that ends this segment, where he definitely says the eye and the ear are joined, both what they have create and what they see perceive, well pleased to recognize in nature the language and the sense and the anchor of my purest thoughts. That they're in this sort of disturbing moment in this long series of low places where you can find this, the sense sublime. It's nature and in the mind of man. And then, what would you want to say about emotion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things?
He really is dancing around it, and he's got something really big on the end of his line. And I think by sometimes he understates it. He says of something far more deeply interfused. Something. I mean, like, you can't think of a less committed term. You know, it's not even a simile. You know, it's not of something, and then emotion and a spirit. I mean, it. Perhaps it's simply this this enlightenment era when you don't want to talk too much about God, because God is definitely passé. But you can't write poetry without something big on the end of the line.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So and what he's talking about is his own experience, which is not something big on the other end of the line. So what he, it's curious. I mean, I'm really fascinated with it. It's hard work to do this well. To be able to talk about your own experience in such a sense that it's not just my own little petty little thing that's going on with me, but there's something else there. And I don't know what it is, but I want to be faithful to my experience and keep on working and seeking it, you know, to come. I mean, that's a lot of what happens at Holden. I mean, people are trying to hunch out what's on the other end of that line, you know, and we have these traditional scriptural terms that we could use, but sometimes people don't want to use that. So, and so here's Wordsworth, it's hard work.
It's what's always made me love him. I mean, for all of the it gets so heavy sometimes, and it's sort of passé also to be a Wordsworth fan, to go into feminist political circles and say, hey, I think William Wordsworth's a great poet, but I think he is. Something big on the end of the line, and he's constantly going, God, he's not going God, he's going, gee, am I right about this? I really could be wrong. And he struggles with it constantly to the point of being, that he writes a 600-page poem about the development of his mind. But still, he's constantly out there going, I feel this way, damn it, And I can tell you how I got to feel this way. So he does, I grew up here and I went to Cambridge and I studied here and then I went and was in the French Revolution and I did this and I did that and
but it works. What you have to also say about the prelude is that for all of the ponderousness, there are places where it is just stunning.
Oh.
And if you didn't have the ponderous stuff, it would not be true to life. And it is true to life. I mean, he's really dolty at points and he's just very, just dragging you through, and then it just, up in the Alps, ties on a great one,
Climbing Mont Blanc in the Alps. I would heartily recommend if anybody ever wants to like really plow through something while you're at Holden. I regret that I didn't bring the prelude to sit here and read.
I bet you it's here.
You think so? The last time I did read it, though, was in my most centered place in the universe in Canada, up in canoeing. And I just brought along the prelude and sat on a rock and read it, and it just rings bells.
What you have to say about Wordsworth, and if you were to put him into the context of Western thought, is that he is the first one who says it's okay to think about yourself.
That's
and,
right.
And to start from below and trust that you're going to get somewhere. Because nobody did it up till then. It was just totally, being self-conscious was just a waste of time. And you were seen as being a fool to even begin doing it. And Wordsworth did it, and he did it well, for his time, and actually for our time as well.
Oh, for sure.
He really is someone who is a breakthrough person in terms of Western culture. And the people that follow him don't even try what he did because they know they can't do it. Nobody can do what Wordsworth did.
Mm-hmm.
None of the poets who read him tried it.
Though they all have spoken to him ever since. Anyone who's ever picked up a pen and written poetry in English, somewhere in there is in dialogue with Wordsworth. And you pick it up and you go, oh, talking to Wordsworth there. And especially on the importance of, I mean, some of the more trendy ways we can talk about it or in vogue ways, talking about storytelling, telling my story, reclaiming. I mean, he, the importance of personal experience and the telling of one's story starts here, I think, in English, anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know about other languages. And then, of course, though, at the end, and we can wrap this up, but you have to.
What is going on here?
it's like he suddenly wakes up and remembers he's with his sister, right? But I think that, if this weren't here, this poem would be, what's the word, solipsistic?
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, and Wordsworth would be solipsistic. For all of the hard time that that I give him, he really did believe that the poet and poetry and the things that he was thinking were beneficial and important for other people and redemptive for other people too, and that they should look at them. And so he did have an outward directed part of himself too, though he sort of in this description, I think, or in this moment in his writing, he's sort of imposing himself over his sister Dorothy. But he does sort of, it's like the safety valve of the poem. Well, if I've been wrong up till now, and if I'm just kidding myself about the redemptive power of this habitual honing of one's feelings in the presence of nature, I see it here in my sister, and I want to praise it in my sister, and I want to hope that sometime in the future she'll be able to remember being here with me, and I won't be, it will not have been for naught. It's sort of how I feel, how, you know, when I feel nice about him, I want to say that that's how it feels, though he's a little tough on his sister. He says, "Oh, yet a while may I behold in thee what I once was." It's like, stay there, don't move, don't be anybody else, don't do anything. Let me just look at you and see myself.
I don't get that exactly. Does he mean that she is talking to him about the way he used to be as you're sitting there? And or, I mean, is he totally projecting on her? You know, do you have a sense that this is just all in his mind, or is there actually some interaction that's going on? That where she really has an active part in recalling to him his former self. I mean, I can't.
There's only intimations of the fact that they may have been having a conversation when he says, "In thy voice, I catch the language of my former heart." Though she may have been singing. I mean, you know, you know, she may have been going, "Oh, look at that." It's very hard to say. It's very hard to say, and that's why I have a little criticism of him here, because he makes Dorothy, it does feel like Dorothy's just, first of all, he forgot about her until the end of the poem. He doesn't say, "Five summers and five long winters, and here I am again with my sister." No, he said, "Here I am. Oh, and but then there's you." So it's a, I think it's a double edge. It's a couple of edges there. And he, but then he goes on to say, again, some of his best poetry. "And this prayer I make, knowing that nature never did betray the heart that loved her. 'Tis her privilege through all the years of this our life to lead from joy to joy, for she can so inform the mind that is within us, so impress with quietness and beauty, and so feed with lofty thoughts, that neither evil tongues, rash judgments, nor the sneers of selfish men, nor greetings that where no kindness is, blah, 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 shall prevail against us." And so when you feel like this, I hope you remember me, sort of what he's saying there. I've written in the margins, "Winning the future through Dorothy." Be like me. And then I'll be, I mean, and everybody has that feeling. You know, I mean, children or whatever. Win the future through me. And again, lots of oral images, sweet sounds and harmonies. My voice, your voice, our voice, thy voice, were more dear to me both for themselves and for thy sake.